Since September 11, 2001, more than 2.7 million Americans have fought America's battles in Iraq and Afghanistan. Today's guest has written a searing new account of those wars and the men and women who have served in them. He's C.J. Chivers this week on Story in the Public Square. Hello and welcome to Story in the Public Square, where storytelling meets public affairs. I'm Jim Lutis from the Pell Center at Salve Regina University. Alongside me is my friend and co-host G. Wayne Miller from the Providence Journal. Story in the Public Square is an effort to study, celebrate, and tell stories that matter. We do that by visiting each week with the best contemporary storytellers, authors, scholars, filmmakers, and journalists, really anyone using or studying narrative to explain the world we live in. This week, we're joined by Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist for the New York Times, C.J. Chivers, who is also the author of a new book, The Fighters. Chris, thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
So we want to talk about The Fighters. It's a remarkable book, The Fighters, Americans in Combat in Afghanistan and Iraq, and it's receiving tremendous praise, including from my co-host here, who called it, and I'm quoting, astonishing. So we'll talk about that in a moment, but let's talk about what led you to write that book. You're a Marine veteran. You're a correspondent for the New York Times. What led you to write this book in particular?
So I occupied over the years a fairly peculiar role at the Times. As a large institution, we can have reporters covering the wars in many different ways. And my writ was really to cover it from the ground, to capture the experience of combat from the people engaged in combat. And over the years, I kind of came to see that stories in the newspaper, you know, article-length stories weren't enough, that in order to make it cohere into something fuller, I needed to step back and spend more time on it. So my motivation was to try to capture something fuller of this arc of experience from 2001 to almost the present day.
And was this based on reporting that you had done while you were forward with units, or was this something that you went and reported after you decided to write the book?
It was both. I mean, most of the characters I was with at one point or another in their careers overseas, and I was at many of the events that are depicted in the book, but I also had to do a lot more work than that. Being present's not enough. I mean, you can only have so much interaction with someone in real time, so I, in each case, went back to the characters and invested a long time in a series of immersive interviews and going through their scrapbooks and emails, journals where they had them and the like, in order to build a fuller account. And then we built it out, so we would go to other people who were present at the events and to their families and do extended interviews. So it was a combination of the two, but in almost every case, the genesis was overseas.
How many times were you overseas actually witnessing on the ground combat and operations?
I don't know. I didn't count. I mean,
multiple times, many times.
Yeah, I lost track of the number of patrols and operations years ago. I mean, it was a lot.
Did you find that your military background gave you a perspective and I guess I want to use the word welcome for military members that others might not have had?
I mean, it's interesting. I don't know. I can't speak to others' experience because I had my own and I tended to work alone just with the photographer, the two of us. So I'm not a very good witness on what other journalists' experiences were like. In my own case, it was a mixed bag. I mean, it's certainly because of my sort of professional background, I had a cultural connection, if you will, to many of the characters and to many commanders and units, and that got me a lot of access to rank and file, frontline fighting. On the other hand, sometimes it created hassles because people might expect that you could plug into the prevailing narrative and recount it, even if that narrative was nonsensical or false. And so there was sometimes an expectation from the military that I was going to go along with their view rather than my view or the soldiers' views. And so it was up and down. I would say it very much depended on the day and the interaction.
What drew you to journalism? So you as I said, you had served in the Marine Corps. You left as a captain, right? Honorably discharged. Why go to school for journalism?
Well, I grew up in a house rich with newspapers. I mean, we had three newspapers a day come to the house, and I was a avid news consumer from, you know, from learning how to read. And when I was leaving the Marine Corps, I had the idea that I wanted to be a writer. I also had a pretty keen understanding that I didn't know anything, that I didn't have anything to say. And I took on journalism as sort of an apprenticeship. I wanted to learn how to be a newspaper writer for the same reason I wanted to be in the infantry. I wanted the basic fundamental tasks of the profession. When I arrived, thinking that I would do a few years as a newspaper writer, I immediately found out I loved it and that journalism was working for me. And so I stuck around and I gave up the idea of being a writer of anything else, and I've been a journalist ever since.
Wow. So you went to Columbia and you received your master's degree there. You were valedictorian of the class. You then went to the Providence Journal for 4 years. And then you went to the New York Times, and if I have this correct, you went to a bureau in Lower Manhattan, and you were there at the time of September 11th.
So the Times hired me with the mandate to cover war, but with the understanding, because it was 1999, that there weren't wars on, where they needed an extra set of hands. Our foreign staff was covering the wars from the bureaus. But they said, history tells us there will be other wars and we're going to need more people. And in the interim, they put me on the police beat. And so I was covering the New York Police Department and crime and the city generally for a couple of years until 9/11 happened. And then everything changed.
In your book, you write about six people, a fighter pilot, a medic, helicopter pilot, a grunt, an infantry officer, and a special forces sergeant. How did you select those six people? You must have met hundreds, if not more, in all of your time. What about those six?
So the answer simply is ruthlessly. I knew I needed a set of characters who would be distinct from each other and could stand alone so that a reader would be interested in reading about them and their experiences. But that also that I needed characters who each could serve a specific purpose, a specific place or phase or period of the war, or a well-known location or operation of the war, and different jobs. And so my idea was, I mean, think of it as an orchestra or a small garage band, to have characters each playing ultimately different and distinct roles to make something coherent. Because my ambition was to tell a fuller narrative that captured the wars and the fighting experience of the wars from 2001 forward. And there were a lot of very different, very common experiences. I could never find one character that would capture them all. So I selected these characters with an eye that they would cohere together into something fuller.
We could talk about each of the six and do an entire program on them, but I think given our time constraints, we'll focus on two. First, Lane McDowell. He opens the book. He's a fighter pilot. His first mission was over Kosovo in 1999. Talk about what he did there and something that gave him some degree of doubt, for lack of a better term, in that very early stage of his career and, of course, before the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan.
So I chose Lane for a couple of reasons that are obvious. One, he opens the book. He was off the coast of Pakistan when 9/11 happened, so he was already in position for the inevitable and predictable retaliation. And he would be flying in those initial sorties. I also chose Wayne because he's in the book, you'll see there are characters who are sort of single tour, 4 year single contract soldiers, and there are those who are lifers. Like Lane had been compelled to join the military long before 9/11 and for different reasons from 9/11. And he had served already in combat in both Iraq and in Kosovo. And in Kosovo, he had been involved in a number of strikes. And one of those strikes, he was airstrikes, you know, the fighter pilots life had changed by the time Kosovo came along, and they were no longer training just to dogfight. They were training to put ordnance on the ground and to support ground troops and to do airstrikes. And Lane had done an airstrike in which he had some concerns that he may have killed civilians, and that had stayed with him for a few years. When 9/11 happened, Lane obviously felt completely clear of conscience about attacking the Taliban or al-Qaeda, but he still, and it plays out later over his career, was haunted a bit by the past strike and the question of whether or not he had inadvertently killed civilians.
Does the grappling with that sort of bigger issues, does that make him a better officer? Does it hinder his ability to do his job? How does that play out in the, you know, where the rubber meets the road?
Well, I'll give you a different answer. I'd say it makes him a better person. I mean, war is a set of state-sanctioned crimes, right? You're doing things that in any other context would be a violation of God's laws or the statutory laws. You're destroying property, you're displacing people, you're killing people. This is not easy, even for people who I know who have killed in what we would consider clean, perfectly legal circumstances against targets that were valid and unquestionably clearly combatants who were fighting back. Many of those troops suffer a moral fraid afterward, trying to process it. And I think it's both natural and good that people wrestle with that. And I was drawn to Lane's moral struggle because I thought it was important to portray that the combatants who we have deployed in our name since 2001 often are sort of portrayed stoically or starkly and without a lot of the emotional content of their actions having an effect upon them. And I was moved by Wayne's struggle. Now, to answer your question more directly, I'd say it made him a better officer.
Yeah,
because when we had ground forces in Afghanistan who he was supporting later, he had to make decisions about other airstrikes. And harming the wrong people in the proximity of ground troops, American ground troops, makes the ground troops a lot more difficult. And so I would argue that it made Lane a better officer.
So he was an exceptional pilot. I mean, just totally good at what he did. He was on a track if he wanted to maybe command an aircraft carrier to, you know, to get more stripes. And
Lane's what you'd call a water walker in the jargon. He was a fast tracker. And he could have been an astronaut or could have been, as you said, a nuclear aircraft carrier.
Yeah, commander. He could have been a high place officer with a guaranteed future and glory and whatever. And yet, and again, you tell the story brilliantly. There's a passage where he's flying when he makes finally the decision that he's leaving. He just flies and gets back to the love of flying. And
cloud surfing.
Which I had never heard. It's a brilliant passage like so many. But he decides at the end to take a post in Alaska, which is essentially, as I understand it, a desk job. Why? He gave up, quote unquote,
You're capturing Lane. He's a pretty richly human character, but in that case, he wanted to be with his family. He deployed so many times, and even when he wasn't deployed, he had a long tour as a test pilot, which, I mean, you know from The Right Stuff how intense a life that is. And he had been so committed to his career that as he watched his children getting older, I think he wanted to commit more fully and completely to his family, which is also admirable.
Absolutely. We need to take a quick moment for station identification. This is Story in the Public Square, where storytelling meets public affairs. You can join us four times every weekend on Sirius XM Satellite Radio's popular POTUS channel. That's the Politics of the United States, channel 124. And we hope you will. We produce Story in the Public Square with a remarkable and talented team at Rhode Island PBS, and we're lucky to work with them. I'm Jim Lutis, Executive Director of the Pell Center for International Relations and Public Policy at Salve Regina University in historic Newport, Rhode Island. If you want to connect with me on Twitter, I'm @JMLutis. Joining me, as always, is my friend and co-host G. Wayne Miller. He's an award-winning journalist with the Providence Journal and the author of 17 books. You can connect with him on Twitter, too, at G. Wayne Miller, all one word. And our guest this week is a retired Marine infantry officer, a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist with the New York Times, and now the author of an incredible new book, The Fighters. C.J. Chivers is on Twitter, at C.J. Chivers. Let's talk for a minute about Dustin Doc Kirby. He's a medic. He's saved countless lives on the battlefield. But you describe him as someone who is haunted, might not be the right word, but he has questions about the lives that he's saving and what they're going to be, given the fact that battlefield medicine can save lives today that it wouldn't have saved even 20, 30 years ago. Talk to us a little bit about his story and those anxieties, for lack of a better
word. So in one instance, his former roommate was a turret gunner in a vehicle on a raid that his company, he was a Marine, he was a corpsman, a Navy corpsman assigned to a Marine weapons company. And they did a raid on a little hamlet outside of the village of Karma, the town of Karma. And after the raid, as they were getting back into their vehicles, a sniper showed up and shot his former roommate through the head, Lance Corporal Colin Smith. And the round went high through the helmet and exited high out the back of the helmet and passed through the upper portion of Colin's brain. And Doc was there almost immediately. Doc gave him life-saving breaths and kept him alive for a few minutes, got the initial bandages on him, helped move him to the helicopter, which it was just good fortune for Colin and Doc that there happened to have been a helicopter on the operation, and it heard the medevac call, it turned around and came back, so it was only a few minutes, and got him onto the helicopter, and Colin was flown away to surgery, and then on to Germany and on to the United States. So the adrenaline wears off. You do what you're doing in a circumstance like that. Your training kicks in, your youth and your vitality and your sense of commitment kick in, and Doc performed remarkably well, and Colin survived. Then the adrenaline wears off, and Doc is trying to decide what's Colin's life going to be like. You know, he ended up beside me with his helmet, Colin's helmet, and a piece of brain was still in the helmet, a small piece, you know, maybe the size of a coin. And Doc, once he calmed down, as you do, and began to think, as you will, he wondered what life awaits Colin. And it haunted him. The word you used was the right word. It haunted him for some run of days. And then Doc himself was wounded. There was a roadside bomb that hit his vehicle, and he was stunned. And so he went under a period of observation, like they do with troops who have concussions. And so he was at an aid station himself, and a phone call came in, and it was for Doc. In Iraq, you know, nobody calls anyone on a random line in Iraq, and it was Colin's dad calling from the States, saying he was with his son and thanking him for saving his son's life. And Doc began to come around then. I won't say that Doc completely came around for a long time. I mean, that relieved him of some of the burden and freed up his mind and his bandwidth to think about other things, which he did. But I think for years, Doc wondered if Colin was going to have a life that Doc would want. And ultimately, Doc has concluded, because he's met with Colin and Colin has thanked him himself, that he did the right thing.
Good.
He did the right thing.
But then Doc himself gets shot.
Doc himself was shot about 2 months later on Christmas Day.
What happened?
He was on a rooftop post. And he was shot through the mouth at the end of the shift as he stepped out of the bunker. There was a sniper, again, who probably was sighting on that bunker for some time. And Doc stepped out, and the bullet passed through one side of his mouth and exited the other. And that was 2006. And we're 12 years later, and he's still living in the aftermath of that. He's had something like 30-plus reconstructive surgeries. and a lot of therapy and a lot of struggle. And I'm happy to say over the last couple of years, he's been doing quite a bit better.
He met former President George W. Bush. What did he tell him?
Well, it was an interaction at the Bush Presidential Center or Library in Texas, and Doc was there at a motorway. He was at a NASCAR event, and it was a well-attended event, and Doc was being honored as a veteran, and one of the former president's staff members was there and invited him to see the president. And Doc and his whole family, because the whole family's on this journey together, were brought in for a meeting with President Bush. And, you know, Jim, if I could hold off answering, because I don't want to give away the end of the book.
That's fair enough.
I want to get back to Doc, because you describe in graphic detail everything that happens in the book, but focusing on his wound, it's a graphic and intimately told account of being shot and what happens after you're shot. We were talking about this in the green room. You had a choice there. You didn't have to be as detailed as you were, but you decided to, and I think properly so. Does that not fit with your another one of your overall objectives here, which was to show combat as it really is, not the way the sanitized version you might get on a newsreel or in another book? And I've gone on at great length here, so.
So it's impossible not to tell the story of Doc without bringing you through this probably the central experience of his life. And so, yes, I stopped and sort of slowed things down and tried to bring the reader into Doc's head as, you know, he realizes he's been shot through the mouth. The bullet passed through laterally, so, and low, you know, it was below the nose. So Doc's faculties were intact. He just couldn't talk because his tongue had been shot and his teeth had been broken and he was sick with blood. And he didn't realize initially what had happened. You know, the bullet passed through in a snap. I mean, in a blink, the bullet's already gone by. And, you know, he had felt a flash of light and wondered what had happened. And he tried to talk. He was with another Marine, and he tried to talk to the Marine, and the words didn't form. And then he could see the Marine's face sort of elongating in shock and then horror. And Doc gradually, because he's a doc, starts to assess himself, and he realizes what's happened. And yes, I thought that it's a duty not to airbrush these things and to bring the reader into the level of experience that Doc was willing to share. And Doc was very, very open about it. And so, yeah, that was a very conscious decision to relate all of that.
You know, so we're sitting here in July of 2018 talking about this. America's been at war for almost 17 years now. Mm-hmm. And there's a human cost that I think is not fully understood by most Americans, unless they've had some exposure to the military. The reporting you've done, the experience you've had, where do you see us on this as a nation, sort of on this journey? Is there an end in sight to these wars? Are we, as some analysts have called it, is this the forever war?
There's an end, I'm sure. It's certainly not in sight. I mean, we're in multiple wars right now, and there's no articulated end state for any of them. So no, I don't, in the foreseeable future, see them going away. I don't even see yet a real conversation about what the ends might look like.
Yeah, and partly that's sort of the nature of American politics right now, right? Is that we gloss over these really profound questions, even though they're Americans still in harm's way. Is that, where do you come down on that?
Well, my book's purposely not that political. Yeah. I mean, I try to stay within the experience of the characters who, in the main, were not political. I mean, they were acting for the people on the right and left and trying to do the jobs to which they were assigned and leave a good account of themselves before their tours ended. I think it is the nature of our politics not to question the Pentagon,
right,
to sort of sanctify, even deify our veterans, and to not put the hard questions to ourselves as a country about these wars. And it's one of the perils of being an island nation. These are far away, and we don't see them really unless we look. The truth is that the truth is out there. They've been written about. They've been covered. If you want to pursue an understanding of this war, it's out there. You can do it on the internet. You can do it with the right books and the right documentaries. You can do it on YouTube. It's all there. But people are choosing, in the main, not to invest in understanding it, much less changing it.
You do make a sort of conclusion, though, in the preface, and it's not strictly a political conclusion, but let me just read a bit. On one matter, there can be no argument. The foreign policies that sent these men and women abroad with an emphasis on military activity and visions of reordering nations did not succeed. It is beyond honest dispute that the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq failed to achieve what their organizers promised, no matter the party in power or the officers in command.
One of the reasons I don't answer that politically is I see it as a systemic failure of the bureaucracy and both parties. I don't blame it on one president over the others. They all left us where we are, which is in a state of continued war with the ambitions of which are not entirely clear and the execution of which often feels adrift.
And both parties own these wars now, too. Right.
Yeah, absolutely.
Just a few seconds left here, but so what's next for Chris Chivers?
So I'm working on an adaptation of one of the chapters right now for my employer, for the New York Times Magazine. That's my next few days. And after that, it will be the weekend, and I hope to go cold.
Well, Chris Chivers, the book, The Fighters, is a remarkable examination of Americans at war. Thank you so much for being with us. He's C.J. Chivers. The book is The Fighters. You want to check it out. That's all the time we have this week. But if you want to know more about Story in the Public Square, you can find us on Facebook and Twitter or visit PellCenter.org, where you can also catch up on previous episodes. He's G. Wayne Miller. I'm Jim Lutis, inviting you to join us again next time for more Story in the Public Square.